Hello, and welcome to Detox the World's Guided Rose Cleanse. You are listening to the Week 2 live Q&A call with Natalia Rose, recorded January 10th, 2012. Thank you for joining, and we wish you well on your journey.
Welcome back, everyone, and congratulations on graduating into Week 2. And I echo your thoughts, Amanda. I really appreciate how everyone's been so supportive of each other. I'm really excited about this call because now we're not just talking about cleansing in theory. You're actually in the thick of it. You're actively awakening and releasing your old waste and all those icky byproducts from it. So I've pulled a bunch of questions from the virtual living room to address after a short talk about body care that I want to discuss with you guys a little bit. And then we'll open up the conversation to your personal questions. And I just want to say thank you again to all the wonderful participants who are sharing their questions and answering each other's questions, who are really opening up pretty fearlessly about their concerns. They're lending support and inspiration to each other. And I also want to thank Anna and Amanda so much for their wonderful leadership on Thursday's call. Finally, everyone, just thank you for continuing to trust the process and for being patient to receive my responses to questions. So your responses have generally been really spot on. It's been great to see that. So first I want to talk a little bit about body care and maintenance. Our bodies are made up at their core of living light energy, but the material composition of our bodies, as you know, is made up of cells, and these cells are very porous. They're porous because they must be actively moving substances through. They're the opposite of stagnant. Primarily, our cells, tissues, bloodstream, lymph, circulatory, respiratory, reproductive, and neurological systems need to be flowing and conducting. That has to happen. That's a fundamental primary function, flow that has to go on. So imagine, if you will, for a moment, a physical system with all these parts from the smallest cell to the unified activity of all these systems that I just mentioned, moving and flowing without any obstruction. Okay, if you get this picture and you can go into your body and imagine all of these systems alive with this this flow that we're talking about. So if you get this picture, it's really dynamic. It's like a rainforest with everything alive and in vivid color. Each part is doing a job purposefully, joyfully, and successfully. Now imagine a body like this in an environment that is also flowing and conducting. So let's go back to the rainforest, since it has such a dynamic set of living things, and they're likewise joyfully conducting, really like an orchestra of color. Exotically colored birds, flowers, these verdant leaves, got the rich soil with all these earthworms and blossoming fertility. The air is dewy and negatively charged, and there are pockets of glowing light from the sun coming between the trees. Even imagine a river rushing nearby. Now, this body and this rainforest contain all the same chemical elements. They flow into and out of each other, nourishing one another. They can't infect each other with anything alien. So one really can't get dirty in this environment, because what is dirt? It's not soil. Soil is living and clean. It's not dirty or filthy. It springs forth flowers and fruits. So both the human and all the other living organisms in this ecosystem that we're imagining, they stay clean because life is clean by nature. Life, cleanliness, and nature, they all go hand in hand. You won't find life where there's filth, and filth is unnatural. Dirt or filth or things that need to be washed off the natural organisms, those come from alien synthetic sources. When nature is tampered with, it becomes denatured. So now we have a problem. Now we have something that can infect man and his environment. Now we have substances that can infect the flowing river and pass along disease. Now we have something that can pass noxious fumes into the air and harm us from within through our lungs and skin and from without by deteriorating the quality of our air and the organisms around us. So flash forward to a world where everything is denatured, circa 2012, and you'll see a world riddled with disease, both human and the living world of organisms and elements we cohabitate with. And then we take the allopathic model of medicine, which is to treat symptoms, or rather to silence symptoms, which is all allopathic medicine does. It's drugs and procedures. They actually can't cure symptoms, though they often refer to the silencing of symptoms as curing them, which is false. It's like taping a screaming baby's mouth shut and saying the baby isn't screaming anymore. Well, we all know that baby's still screaming. Its heart and soul are screaming even more loudly than before, because now it has not only the same gripe it had originally that it was crying about, but now it's being prevented from communicating, and that becomes intolerable. Well, the body has the same experience. Our body's symptoms are simply their way of communicating with us, their way of telling us to stop what we're doing because we're doing harm. Now we have these myriad symptoms and diseases from the filth created within our bodies from the denatured substances, from refined foods to plastics, radiation, and then it's exacerbated by medications and, of course, the generations of living this way that have ruined and just compromised the DNA of offsprings for thousands of years. But most acutely, this has happened in the last 1,000 years and at exponentially greater levels in the last 100 years. Coming back to present day, though, we now live in a world of extreme filth. The cells and systems are not flowing and conducting, and there's very little outside our bodies in the form of clean water and air that we can use to conduct with for our well-being, like we would have been able to do in that rainforest scenario. Most of us, of course, live in cities and suburbs, so we have bodies that are stagnant relative to what they were designed to be, and we're living in a stagnant environment. So this brings us to the question of how to care for our bodies. When we think of body care, our minds may go to body care products. So let's head to the drugstore, because that's where most people get their body care products from. Note that the term body care product in and of itself, when we're going into the drugstore, is deceptive. As you're discovering through this process, these things are not remotely going to care for our bodies. In fact, if we're going to begin to care for our bodies truly, we will stay far, far away from drugstores. So how do most people, quote, clean themselves? Okay, they use soaps and toothpaste and body washes and shampoos and mouthwashes. These items are innately filthy. By this, I mean their ingredients are denatured. They're synthetic, and almost every ingredient offends the living cells and tissues in our organism. So putting these products into our body and on our body is putting more filth onto and inside the body. It's not removing it or, you know, caring for it in the remotest sense. So you'd do better to dig yourself a hole in the ground and give yourself a mud bath. The only way to clean filth is with natural alkalinity, now that we've defined what filth really is. Natural alkalinity is the best soap there is. So when we talk about cleansing the cells and tissues of the body, we have to get nature's alkalinity, nature's soap, into our bodies. Nature's soap is healthy conducting electrons. Natural alkalinity is made up on a subatomic level of atoms with lots of extra life force rich electrons circulating around the outer shell of the atom. More of these electrons must be present than the number of protons in the nucleus for it to be a negatively ionically charged substance and fit the bill as nature's soap. Okay, so on a material and etheric level, we find this in our non-denatured, emphasize non-denatured, raw fruits and vegetables, particularly the leafy greens and ripe organic fruits, which unfortunately have become so denatured and we've become so denatured that we aren't able to utilize them the way we would otherwise. And we'll find it in vital living water and air. So these are all the things that are fairly difficult to come by today. They're more valuable than the mansions, the diamonds, the fast cars, and anything else you can think of because they have the source of life in them, and they can help fix us. We've been so foolish to put non-living things before living things in our culture, and of course, mining precious gems and metals from the earth, which keep the earth in balance, is, you know, a whole category into itself for discussion. But that aside, what you're doing when you're undertaking a cleanse, this cleanse in particular, is the conscious process of putting nature's soap into your body by way of your concentrated raw green leafy vegetable juices and leafy green salads, and then washing the filth out through your active eliminative organs. And those are your bowel, your skin, your kidneys, your liver, and your lungs. And of course, with the help of really prolific colonics and enemas, which ensure that the copious amounts of this alien filth that created the stagnation to begin with effectively leaves. So the stagnation is the cause of almost all symptoms, all diseases, skeletal muscular degeneration, imbalanced weight, you name it. I say almost all because the inherited lineage is such a huge contributing factor. The point is that denatured substances, whether they were taken in by you or by your forefathers and foremothers, is what has been the thorn in your side, so to speak. You're, in effect, doing a multi-generational detoxification along with a detoxification of your personally clogged physical filter when you live this cleansing lifestyle. So this should give you a whole new perspective on body care. For women, especially young girls, I hope this helps you reconsider your body care products and the offensive impact that tampons and inorganic pads have in particular, and then, of course, the whole slew of items in your bathroom. It's no surprise the hysterectomy, which is the removal of the uterus and often the ovaries and cervix as well, is the second largest surgery performed on women in the U.S. That's after cesarean section. So the second largest surgery performed on all on U.S. women is hysterectomy, the removal of the reproductive organs. It makes us really, really wonder how we're caring for our body, what we're buying at the drugstore, what we're using for our menstruation. It really, really begs the question. So the way we care, well, I should say, quote, care for our bodies and, quote, clean our bodies and put synthetic substances into our orifices only exacerbates the filth we already have accumulated from the common foods and drinks and medicines. We need nature's soap inside and out. Ideally, we would sell in tissue cleanse and then go and live in the alkalinity by a clean ocean, in the Tetons or in the Alps, in a clean forest. But for most of us, that's not going to happen today. Maybe it will tomorrow. You could be like Amanda and her family and, you know, up and leave and go to Hawaii and leave behind your very successful life or, you know, in business in New York. So, you know, don't dismiss this, even if it sounds impossible for you today. I'm not dismissing it, even though it doesn't seem like it's happening to me today. But, you know, let's all work with what we have and where we are today. You know, I'm still personally in the thick of it in New York City, and I've learned not to bemoan that because I used to. I found that it's really unproductive to get too down on that. It's what is productive, what I found to be very, very productive, is to make sure that I can stay filth-free and non-stagnant while living in the city. And that's what we can all do. But, you know, that's, of course, living the cleansing lifestyle. But that's what those of you who really get the value of cleansing will wind up doing, because you'll see that that's where true wealth lies. The life force is the most valuable commodity there is. Okay, I'm going to say that again. The life force is the most valuable commodity there is. You know, if we can stoop for a moment to even call it that. In the near future, I predict it will be recognized and, you know, probably sadly attempted to be exploited as such. But for now, we cleansers, you know, we just seem to be a little too obsessed with what we do to people for whom it's not a priority, for whom that proverbial penny just hasn't dropped. So call us crazy as we wring filth through our sweat in the sauna and magnetize our acid waste every day by drinking our leafy green juices and plug ourselves up to speculums to irrigate and purge the noxious waste that the nature's soap has loosened and delivered to our large intestine. You know, call us crazy for actually caring for our bodies in a real way. But we're purifying our cells and systems so they can function properly in this crazy denatured world. To me, it seems like the most sane thing in the world. I think to anyone who can see the depth of the problem and the magnitude of the waste and who can comprehend the compilation of the waste and the implications of an obstructed system, it will seem the most sane thing in the world. There's a wonderful set of books by a woman called Marlo Morgan. It's a two-set. One's called Mutant Message from Down Under, and the other one, which Anna Ladd-Griffin gave to me recently, I didn't realize she'd come up with a second one, is called Mutant Message from Forever. I can't recommend these highly enough, but in the books, the author, Marlo Morgan, explains that the Australian Aborigines call themselves the real people, and they call us the mutants. So the modern world has mutated us so much that we don't even operate like humans were designed to. And I'm not speaking merely just physically, but behaviorally as well. This is why we're so dangerous to ourselves, to each other, and to the planet. It begs the question, are we even humans anymore when we're so blocked up? Our behavior, our emotions, our psychology is so warped. What are psychologists studying when they study modern man living so separate from nature, who's become riddled with diseases of the body and mind and crises of the soul? Is this normal human behavior, or is it abnormal? And if it's abnormal, how can we call it human psychology? The Aborigines might think it should be called mutant psychology. I tend to agree. If we're like that crying baby who finally becomes an adult and gets to rip the tape off our mouth and finds that we're manic, deeply troubled, depressed, confused by our world, what is it that we want at that stage? To be, quote, normalized? To be made to believe that a system of blockages and muzzling of the human spirit is normal and okay, so that we can come to terms with it and accept it and be accepted in that culture? You know, if you found that the holidays left you feeling empty, are you then supposed to act like you think the holidays are a really joyful time of year? If you feel trapped in your suburban houses in a life that is perfect on paper, but actually you feel like you're living in a tomb and you don't understand why, are you supposed to just go and take a pill to make yourself feel okay with it? If you have a child who isn't acclimatizing or acclimating to the paradigm and is acting out because inside it feels wrong to him, should we drug him? Should we just do everything we can to make sure that this bizarre set of belief systems that our culture adheres to should be continued, despite the fact that it's harming every little living thing in it, and that as human beings we must find a way to adapt to it, even if it means shutting off all of our natural instincts and silencing all of our symptoms? Whenever I used to question this lifestyle, I had a tool I would use. I happened to spend a fair bit of time in homes for the elderly growing up for various reasons, so I now have this very clear vision of what goes on there and how the patients look and feel. I had to watch my own father wither away in one of these places when I was 16. I've also been in many hospitals with elderly family members and seen how these patients exist. I know this is a really harsh image, particularly because it hits very close to home for many of us. But what's important to know, and please, I don't say this to frighten you, and fear is the one thing we must get away from above all, but this is where the people of our culture wind up. They wind up broken down from the inside out with failed organs, with an inability to control their bodies, hooked up to all sorts of tubes. They're not there because they've gotten old naturally. They're there because their organs are filled with filth and sadness. In their youth, they agreed to live according to a set of social values, which came with a prescribed lifestyle that promised them happiness, acceptance, health. This is a social paradigm that we were all given, and most of us accepted at least for a little while. We don't see these people on a day-to-day basis, these elderly people who are in the hospitals and the elderly centers, you know, in this state. Just like we don't see other victims of the modern world, the vast many born with handicaps and other physical and mental disabilities. Why am I talking about this? It's a taboo subject. No one wants to think about it. I'm talking about it because that is the effect of living a denatured life. One of my beloved teachers, Gil Jacobs, used to say about the denatured lifestyle, well, I'll paraphrase, that the body will manifest illness That much we know. How and when the illnesses are manifested is the only thing that remains to be seen. So for you, maybe denatured living has manifested in cellulite and osteoporosis, acne, infertility, migraines, or some other symptom that still allows you to have some power over your life and live as an active member of the modern world. But for others, it has manifested far more severely. When we see the elderly in fragile care, we simply see the advanced stages of these illnesses, that which the, quote, lesser illnesses are on a trajectory to become. Something like chronic migraines can become dementia or Alzheimer's down the line if the body's alarm bells of the headaches are not properly listened to and corrected. Years of eating modern farmed animal products on a daily basis and exposure to everyday heavy metal poisoning and radiation, that all accumulates and eventually manifests in some form of chronic neurological disorder like Parkinson's or a stroke. Medical science says they don't know the causes and they don't have the cures for these illnesses. But that's simply not true. Modern science just sees things through their limited lens. All awake, aware humans can tune into how life works and easily put the pieces together. We just have to know that the human body is designed to operate in the way we know it to operate, and we have to know what is offending it. It's amazing that this fulcrum point of health is left out of the medical perspective. Of course, there are some wonderful forward-thinking doctors, and they're thinking more along these lines and more coming along. So, you know, I don't want to, in any way decry all of medical science. But that is what's, you know, being left out of the whole medical paradigm today. So, again, I don't want to raise alarm bells. Your body's doing well enough doing that on its own. But this is very important to explore. What's important is that you know and can navigate this very tricky time in human history. And I hope it makes cleansing make a lot more sense to you. It should make it much more meaningful. This isn't some little beauty endeavor. It's not like taking a fitness class or doing the latest dietetic trend. This is about perceiving the fundamental flaws in our cultural paradigm and protecting ourselves from them. So just wanted to, you know, address that before we get into everything else. On a very positive note, I just wanted to say that it's really fun to read those postings, you know, where you those of you who are having such a great experience and having breakthroughs. And I wanted to kind of read some quotes from some of those today, but now I'm thinking that we may not have the time to do that, so I'll leave you guys to go and explore the virtual living room and read them yourselves. So one of the most common questions that come up, just even in general in this lifestyle, but I noticed it on the boards, is that people who have their first colonic and then they don't have a movement for a few days. So that's very common, and some of you are, you know, aware of why. And there were a couple of good responses there. But just to clarify for the record, when you release so much waste, and your body hasn't released that much waste in the past, it's the body just thinks, wow, well, I never get rid of that much. I've just gotten rid of, you know, like what could be the equivalent of 3 months worth of bowel elimination. So, you know, I don't really need to go tomorrow because I've just had this great release. That's a temporary thing that's going to happen. A body that once the system is started up again, once your bowel and your intestines are the motors revved again, then your body's going to want to remove the waste much more readily. The body naturally has the instinct, the inclination to want to remove waste. It's like it's as much of an instinct to the body as the exhale is to the inhale. So when the body's back in sync and back in harmony, an empty bowel one day that takes in, you know, dinner the next day is going to want to empty that dinner that next morning. And that will happen as a matter of course. But in the interim, there can be all kinds of weird things that happen, including not going for a few days. Shouldn't be more than that. Probably be like maybe 4 days max, which may sound like a lot, but just remember how much the body just got rid of. So don't panic if it's been 4 days and you haven't moved. But you'll want to start moving after that. That's usually the maximum, though, that people go. And then the other concern was that there's kind of a mixed bag, shall we say, of elimination types. So people might be having a bit of diarrhea and loose bowels in the beginning. But that's just because the body is being switched on again, and this motor, again, is being switched on. You have all these hydrating juices. They're hitting old matter. Things have been sitting. And so some of it's going to pass through, and some of it's going to get stuck with the blockages. And really, there's such a compilation of unusual mixed substances in the bowel when you start to cleanse that it can be a bit of, how do I put this? There can be a lot of watery loose stools in the beginning, and it's nothing to be concerned with. It's just the initial, almost like a spitting out of what's sitting, and the body's not used to having this introduction of all these juices and salads. It's just the initial newer waste that's being released. And as that leaves, and then as the deeper stuff, the heavier stuff starts to get reconstituted and moves out, you'll start to have better releases. So don't judge your bowels too closely right now or harshly right now, because you're not, I should say in the first week, it is probably most of you who've had this experience have gotten beyond that already. But, you know, it can really be mixed in the early stages of detox, so expect that. But do expect eventually for it to turn into something that's quite predictably like what you would see, in a cow pasture. Okay. And Anna actually addressed that really well. If you want to go to that post, I forget what it's called, but she talks about the beginning stages of detoxification and what can be included. So she did a real good job answering that. I couldn't do better. Okay, so... see, this one is a colonic a week good enough, or should we be getting more? Are dry, hard bowel movements and lots of gas normal, even if it's abnormal? So this is abnormal for this individual, and she's concerned that maybe she's not hydrating enough. It may be abnormal for you. It's totally normal for the process. So I think, you know, we've kind of gone into that. And then the bowels will indeed pick back up. So some of you, I've noticed, are having symptoms and some of you aren't, which is interesting and absolutely fine. If you're awakening and releasing, that's what matters. But somewhere along the line, you should be feeling like things are changing. So if you're awakening and releasing, if you're not having symptoms of detox, like headaches and sore throats or joint pain, then hopefully you're feeling great. So you're having, your body's communicating to you that something's happening because your head's opened up and it's clearer. Your midsection is more contracted. You should feel that something is going on. So, and if you aren't feeling detox symptoms now, it can still be that down the road they may come up. So, don't expect a linear process. It's generally pretty linear, but then it'll throw you twists and turns, and you'll think, well, how can this be happening? If this didn't happen before, why is it happening now? And didn't I already finish with this stage? Why is it coming up again? It can be cyclical. It can be like a labyrinth. Just hang in there. The good news is that you're on the right track, on the right path. Okay. So, all right, someone asked if detoxing can cause you to be more sensitive to products that you don't normally have sensitivity to. Absolutely, because it makes you, there's a discrepancy in terms I'd like to explain. There's to be sensitive or to be sensitized. So I'd like to focus on the word sensitized, because sensitive implies weakness. Sensitized implies strength. Think of sensitized as having a really sharp antenna. So the cleaner your system gets, the more it's going to be able to detect when something's not good for you. In fact, many people, when they get through stages of detoxification and to levels of cleanliness, they feel like, in a way, it's a handicap because they can't be, they get a headache immediately if they walk into a room where synthetic cleaning detergents were used or sprays. They're more sensitive to anything that's synthetic. And they, and they'll complain or they'll be uncomfortable. But it's really a strength because it means that you're able to detect what is favorable or unfavorable for your organism. And that's a survival attribute. That's something that will keep you surviving, whereas if you're not sensitized to it, you'll continue to live in and amongst that, but it's going to be denaturing you and creating illnesses and disease, and thereby messing with the DNA, which is not only going to affect your life, but is going to affect the survival of your offspring. So, if we're talking about evolution and survival of the species, we want to be sensitized. We want to have a great antenna. And so, if we all started getting this great antenna, we wouldn't tolerate the fumes and the bus smelling up the streets and all the stuff that goes on in our world. We would make big changes, and this is where it all starts. So when we can clean our organism out and we can start to detect what's favorable and what's not, honestly, without being told from the outside, for example, I'm always amazed when I go on vacation, I see smell. These people at the beach or by the pool are spraying on their SPF stuff. And they're clueless as to how toxic and carcinogenic it is. They're just spraying it on because that's what you do now. That's how SPF, that's how sunscreen has evolved product-wise to appeal to consumers. Now you can just spray it on. You have to rub it on. But it's an aerosol can, and whether or not it's even an aerosol can, it's you're inhaling the fumes, and it's one of those things. If you are sensitized, you don't need to be told what's good for you anymore because you will absolutely, without a doubt, know. You'll know when something's wrong. You'll know when there's something wrong with the air quality. You'll make adjustments, and those adjustments will be your survival. Okay, so a few things I want to clarify. There was some mention of this idea that fruit juices are the best cell cleansers, and that was something that somebody mentioned that I had said. Just to correct that, it's not fruit juices, but non-denatured fruits in a clean human organism that are ideal for cell cleansing and ideal nutrition. So it's not the juices, it's the actual fruits. And, fruit juices in general are just, they're too concentrated. You can dilute them if you want. I don't, when we talk about juices, when we talk about fruits, it's a completely different animal to fruit juices. Fruit juices, are only included for fun. But fruits in a clean-celled body, say a body that's not yeasted, are indeed the ideal food for humans, and they're amazing natural alkalinizers. They're amazing, what we call natural soap. And in fact, for yeasted individuals, you can do sweet potatoes. I wouldn't do them every single night, but you can absolutely do them, and you can do, sweet potatoes being the most starchy of all the winter squashes, or what you might categorize as winter squash. But you can do all of those, pumpkin and butternut. I'm probably missing a few, pumpkin, butternut, acorn. So those are all doable, and they're very helpful for those people who want to keep it more vegan but don't want to get sucked into to doing grains and nuts. So they can be really helpful. In fact, raw sweet potatoes, if they're not, if they have some water content to them, I have great ones that I get at my local store. They are delicious raw. And I prefer them to carrots sometimes because they have a more of a nuanced taste. You can spiralize them. You can bake them. You can eat them sliced up raw like chips. You can do this with butternut as well. Any of those things are great. So, don't worry. Don't be frightened of the sweet potato. We like the sweet potato. And then there was a question about raw goat cheeses for pregnancy. The important thing with pregnancy is you don't want to have any of the soft cheeses. That's what the doctors and the powers that be say about consuming cheese while pregnant. It's not about whether it's raw or not. It's whether it's soft. So the hard goat cheeses, like the Altadena, the cheddar-style goat cheese that's hard, those are fine. But the soft ones, which are usually pasteurized anyway, the soft goat cheeses are usually pasteurized. Feta is not always a goat or sheep's milk product. You can easily get goat and sheep's feta, but if it's in a restaurant or something, unless it's indicated on the menu, it's probably a pasteurized cow's milk product. Okay, and then also there's a mention of the idea was to focus on flesh if you're yeasted. Please take that concept out of your mind. We're not focusing on flesh. We're just using flesh. So we're focusing on vegetables. It's a vegetable-centric approach. We merely use fleshes and goat cheese as your, quote, normal food until you need very little of it to feel satisfied. So when we're taking people off the way they were eating before, giving the same thing just to eat vegetables is a bit too harsh, especially because we've taken the nuts out, we've taken the grains out, we've taken the fruits out. There are all these things, the lentils, the other legumes, those are all out of the picture. So the question becomes, well, so what do I eat? So when I mention fish and eggs and goat cheese, I'm not saying they should be our focus. And I'm not saying they're even health generators. They're not health generators. We use them. We use them to help us get across the bridge. Okay, so hopefully that's clarified, but I'm happy to explain that further if need be. Okay, so, and someone mentioned the ionic foot bath. Well, that brings up a question, how do you know if you're cleansing? So the ionic foot bath, it's kind of funny because, you put your feet in it and then, you sit with it for, 30 minutes or so, and then the water turns really brown, and then the person doing the foot bath says, okay, look at all these toxins that you've just released. So the water is a little bit darker. Okay. Now, what you need to know about cleansing is that if you've cleansed, okay, not just awaken the waste, but if you're cleansing, which is the removal of the waste, you will have copious quantities of hard waste matter leave your body. So unless, while your feet are in this bath, the bath is literally turning to heavy sludge, you're not doing any meaningful detoxification. So don't get suckered into any of these things. Also with the psyllium and all these products that claim to be detoxificants, unless you're waking up in huge amounts of your own slime that's purged through your body overnight, or you're pooping like a soldier, you're just not cleansing. So it's just, these are what we call theoretical cleanses, or it's just a setup for a cleanse. Like, for example, psyllium is going to attract a lot of waste in the body, but it also paralyzes the bowel. So there's a potential for a cleanse, but there's not in effect a cleanse. It's just teeing it all up. It's just collecting it all in the body, and that can leave you feeling far worse and in really bad physical straits if it doesn't leave. And anybody who's done psyllium successfully knows it can take up to 2 or 3 colonics a day to actually get that psyllium out of the body. And you might find that a week or two later, you're still having huge psyllium releases. So unless you plan on doing that, which I don't know many people who want to do that, because it's a major commitment to releasing what the psyllium draws up. And if you don't release it, you will feel terrible. I don't recommend doing psyllium. So just kind of keep in mind that what cleansing truly is. And then just like you'll know what's healthy for you and what's not, when you're sensitized, when you know what cleansing is, you can put everything up to that litmus test and say, well, is this actually removing matter and noxious byproducts from my system? Or is it just kind of waking them up? People who do a juice fast without colonics. People who, who eat lots of raw food, go on raw food cleanses, but don't empty their bowels in copious quantities. I'm talking about really releasing everything that the nature soap is awakening. They're having half-baked potential cleanses at best. Okay. There were a couple of questions about kimchi and sauerkraut. Kimchi, sauerkraut, pickles, kombucha, all these things can be great if they're done correctly. The problem is that they're usually consumed after 6 days. So if you buy them in a store, if you're getting a kombucha drink like Synergy or one of these drinks and they've been sitting in the store shelf for a long time, or you buy sauerkraut or you're getting, canned pickle or bottled pickles, but they've been there for a long time, they may have started out having lots of good bacteria in them and being beneficial. But at the stage that you're taking them in, there's just a lot of lactic acid, very little good bacteria, if any. So it really depends on the shelf life, on the duration that it's been between being made, prepared, and being consumed. So if you're getting it fresh and you know it's got lots of vital good bacteria in it, then go for it. But if you are just picking it up and it's, it could be sitting on the health food shelf for 2 weeks, who knows how long it took between the store to the delivery, I wouldn't use that as a healing tool.
There is one more question that was on the forum that we have not addressed yet, mm-hmm. and that was about distilled water. So maybe you could just address water in general and what people can be doing to find themselves clean water.
Yeah, and I beg your pardon. That was supposed to be on my list. Okay, so clean water. It's okay. Remember, we were talking about the commodity of life force. It's going to be one of those things. Getting clean water is going to become like dollar bills. It's very hard to get clean water today. There's clean, healthy water is living water. It comes from the earth. It springs up from the earth. It's moving water. It's alive. And that's the kind of water we should be consuming, and that would keep us humans rather than mutants, that and other things. But so given what we have access to today, what do we do? Distilled water I'm not a fan of because it's had all the minerals removed, it can pull minerals from the system. Now, used in small amounts for, if you're desperate for clean water and you that's all they have in the store, doing it for a day or two or three, it's not going to be a big deal, but it's not the kind of thing you want to take in on a regular basis. There are systems that help to, they say, to revitalize the water. And I think we've talked about it a little bit on the community, although I can't remember where. Maybe it was in one of our last classes. But like the Kagan water and filtration system and these water ionizers that are actually systems you can put into your home, they're supposed to bring back a negative ionic charge to the water. And I personally haven't taken them into my system, and I always use my system as a laboratory because I will feel it if it's real and good. But from what I've heard, people love it. So I'm assuming there's some good there, maybe a lot of good. And then if you don't have access to that, or those are expensive systems and you're not prepared right now to pay for something like that, I find that the best option is to get bottled spring water, meaning in glass bottles. So glass bottles of natural living spring water. So I should say living spring waters as the source going in to glass bottles and then drinking that water. I try to avoid at all costs drinking from anything plastic, anything at all, much less what I would try and get my water from. And the one I like and I drink at home is the Mountain Valley spring water. And that is it's from Arkansas. And let me see if there's a phone number on here. Maybe there is. Yes, there is. Okay, so the website is Mountain Valley Spring. And it's 800-643-1501. I happen to have that right next to me. And they come in lovely sort of greenish glass bottles, and they recycle the glass as well. So that's what's worked for me in the city. I think I'll probably explore getting a Kagan water filtration system when, you know, we're going to be in the same place for sure for a long time. But I definitely would avoid plastic at all costs. And, you know, and just it's a great reminder that these things that we've let slip through our fingers, like sand, are the things that are really going to matter to us moving forward.
Great. And if someone could be so kind that did write the phone number down and the email or the website to post in the living room, that would be fantastic just for the people that may be driving or didn't have a chance to write that down. Okay, so now we can open up the lines. If anybody has any questions, go ahead and press 1 on your keypad, and we'll start addressing questions. 1 on your keypad if you have a question, or you can enter a question into the dashboard on your computer. The first question is from Patrice. Patrice, go ahead. You have the mic.
Hi there. You might have mentioned this, and maybe I didn't hear you. I'm just curious as far as your thoughts on Brita filters. For water.
Well, you know, yeah, that's a good question.
Or any filter. I don't mean to mention a specific brand, but any of those kind of filters.
Yeah. Well, you know, if they can take the chlorine out, that's great. And if they can, you know, relieve the water of some impurities, it's always going to be a help. But I'm really concerned about tap water and just all the things that are put into it. I think they're, not to be a conspiracy theorist or anything, but I think there are a lot of things that they do that, you know, to test in tap water, to test on us to try and recycle things that shouldn't be recycled. There's so much dumping of pharmaceuticals and various chemical agents into our land, into our water systems, and I just would worry that that these common filters aren't getting to that at all. You know, there's so much fluoride, just as one small factor, but the fluoride and the chlorine are the most significant ones that people think of, and it's, you know, I think some of these filters do claim to remove that, but that's just a start.
Okay, thank you.
Pleasure.
Great. Let's go to Lillian. Go ahead, Lillian.
Hi. I was interested to know how long is an ideal mini fast. So how many hours ideally should I leave between the evening meals if, for example, I feel like eating a bit earlier one night, say 5 instead of 8 in the evening?
So you mean while you're doing the rose cleanse and you're already doing your mini fast in the day, is it better to wait until 8 p.m. to eat your meal rather than 5 p.m.?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it comes down more to what you're going to wind up having. Because if you need to have your meal at 5 and you are able to eat the right portion of salad and cooked vegetables and whatever you plan to have, but if you wait till 8 you wind up overeating, then that's not good. But giving your body, you know, it really depends on your cycle and how you feel when you really will do best eating. Because if you elongate the fast to try to benefit from the hours in the day, then you're going to, for lack of a better term, pay the price on the other side by eating before bed and not enabling your body to go into as deep cleansing while you sleep. So really, it's not so much about the time that you have the meal, but what works for you in your life, because either way, you're going to interrupt your cleansing day with a meal. But as we know, it's not really an interruption because it slows things down to a pace where the body can keep up with the waste. So we're not saying that it's negative to interrupt the cleanse in this way, just that it's going to happen at some point, and it doesn't really matter where it happens, only that it happens later in the day to give you the time to mini fast from dinner through that night and next day.
Okay.
So don't get too hung up on that. Just don't overeat too close to bedtime.
Yeah. Is it also occasionally feeling slightly nauseous, but that's after taking a juice. I just wondered if that is it just an effect on the cleanse occasionally, or along with not being able to sleep very well, or as well as I did before the cleanse, which is a bit bizarre too.
Okay, the two things, and they're both completely great questions, very relevant. The first is about the juice making you nauseous, and what can happen is if the two things. One, if the juice is too medicinal, meaning it has too many dark leafy greens in it, it can be too aggressive. It can be too much soap.
Yep.
And that's something that, you know, people often make this, you know, this very common mistake because they think, well, if leafy greens are good, then let me make it as densely green as possible. And then they wind up drinking a kale and parsley juice and they will feel terrible. It's just too intensely medicinally green. The darker the green, the more medicinal it is. We really want to have that nice blend. So if the juices are making you nauseous, first think, is my juice too green? In which case, more cucumber, more romaine, more celery, more lemon. And the other thing is what I often like to talk in terms of the human petri dish. So imagining your body is sort of this mix of chemicals in a petri dish, and then when you introduce a new chemical or a new substance, what's going to happen when that's introduced? So if there's still some stuff kind of moving through your small intestine, or even in your stomach, if it's still fairly early in the day, if you haven't moved well and if things are kind of still stagnant, which they can be in the early days because there's still so much backup, there could be some reverse pressure, there can be some gas, and if the juice hits that, it might make you feel a little bit nauseous. So what I would do is just sip slowly and just take a moment to feel what state your body's in before you take the juice in. When I was in my early stages of cleansing, I would do things like go to a raw food restaurant and order a green juice with my meal. So I'd have a raw food meal and a green juice. And, you know, today I would look at it and just be like, but that's crazy. The green juice, you know, goes first. It goes in the empty stomach. It doesn't go with food. All these factors. But but before you get to that stage, you can often fail to tune in to what's truly going on in the body, where things are sitting, where there might be gas pressure, and then from that point, determine whether juice is actually the appropriate action. It might be that the appropriate action is to go into your exercise first, release some of the gas pressure through the skin and the bowel, and then the juice will be very appropriate. It might be too early in the day for you. You might actually, even though you really want your juice at 9 a.m., you might need to give it a little bit more time. So just do the human petri dish tuning in, and then imagine, okay, now juice is going to hit this. How's it going to feel? Because there's nothing worse than going to the effort of getting this beautiful juice, putting it in your system, and then feeling worse for having the juice. And then it repeating on you for the rest of the day, you know, and that it can happen if you take it at the wrong moment or if it's too intensely green or all these kinds of things. But you'll get better at being able to detect it as you go.
Mm. Okay, great. And was to do with the I'm waking up regularly at about 3:15 or 4:15 and then just finding it impossible to get back to sleep.
Yeah, that's really frustrating. It's part of there's a little burst of life force that are getting going, and your body's, you know, just you're experiencing them. It's a little bit different, so it feels stimulating. So you wake up. That will change. You'll wind up having a really smooth circadian cycle eventually. But I can remember too. Just even when I would do a fast, to this day. You go from how you're normally living and then you suddenly do a juice fast and then you're just flooded with all this energy. You know, sometimes I wish my husband would be traveling because I would get up and I'd start, you know, just redoing the entire house because I'd have all this energy. And, you know, it'd be midnight and my kids would be asleep and I know I need to go to sleep, but it was just, you know, impossible because there's just this charge. And it can be kind of unsettling because it can feel sometimes almost like you're not even touching the ground, which is, you know, when you might use, I'm not speaking directly to you, but to the whole group, but one might use one of, the techniques that Amanda used in the call, Thursday call, to really get grounded again, but you can get kind of flighty and you can have your sleep cycles interrupted. It's all kind of par for the course, unfortunately, but it's a good sign that your body's creating new patterns and bringing the life force in, and the obstruction is leaving.
Great. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Great. Natalia, we have a question from the participant dashboard that I think probably a lot of people have or have had at some point. And the question is, I have a question on colonics. I read that it can upset the good bacteria that flourish in the bowel, and if performed incorrectly, can damage the colon wall. Even though I've done colonics, this is still in the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great question. And it's also a very common one. And forgive me for not getting to it. I feel like it's one that comes up so often that I feel like a broken record on. But the best way to understand this is to imagine, okay, first of all, let's always go back to the fundamental, which is there's all this accumulation in the body. Everything that's gone into the body that isn't a water-containing plant food is getting stuck in the body to a certain degree. About 40 to 60%. It's a lot. It's non-water-containing rubbish going into the body. It's alien. It's synthetic. It's got all these chemicals. It's going in. The body says, I don't know what you want me to do with this. I can't do anything with it, so let me spit out what I can of it, and then the rest of it's going to nest here in these cells and tissues, and maybe I can get to it some other time. So this happening over decades, at this point, your intestine is full, the walls of the intestine are full, the body's trying to always keep its center clear because the nervous system runs right through the center of the intestine and the pathways are always trying to stay open and clear. The body's mission is to keep its vital organs and its pathways healthy and open. So as new food comes in and there's all this impaction, there's the waste matter gets pressed deeper and deeper into the body, into the tissues of the intestine, and basically in an attempt to allow there to be some kind of pathway through for the new food. But imagine these tissues, they are caked in with old waste matter. So if you have all this caked old waste matter, dehydrated stuff, caked on the intestine walls, you're not even getting anywhere near having any kind of healthy flora. Imagine it like a beautiful garden, and that garden has concrete on it, or some sort of asphalt, that might be a better analogy. It's covered in asphalt, and then somebody comes along and starts to remove the asphalt. my son always laughs at the term asphalt, like it's, sorry, the ass's fault. gets a kick out of that. So in this case it is. Actually not. But so the construction team is coming and it's lifting off the asphalt, and these are your colonics and your green juices. They're the construction team, they're lifting off the asphalt. And as it's being removed, all of a sudden you see, oh my gosh, there's soil, and you pick up some of it and there's an earthworm in it. It's amazing. It's amazing that anything was able to live in that. There's maybe only one earthworm, but there's an earthworm. And there's, you know, maybe a little bit of an old sprout. You can tell that something used to live under there. Well, that's your past and potential future flora, your good bacteria, all that stuff that you can now start to garden, start to nurture. It can come back. It'll come back naturally because the rains will come down in the form of the green juice, and the sunshine will come out in the form of the electrons, and suddenly you will become a great gardener of your intestine. But it is only by removing the asphalt that that's going to happen. You're not going to have a garden ever if it's covered in asphalt. So what we're doing is we're removing it. People who talk about disturbing the flora, the balance of the good bacteria in the intestine through colonics, it's ludicrous because the modern person has saturated their colon walls in waste. They're not getting to that at all to begin with. You need to remove the waste first, and then that will come and flourish forth. And that's what happens. It's one of those things where, you know, I can talk about it, but it's unless you've had the experience, and the people who do trust the process do have that experience. It does. They do wind up having great flora. They might not have. They may have been chronically constipated forever, as far as they can go back in time to remember. And then, you know, if they stick with it long enough, their bowel will, and their intestines will come back to life. The peristalsis will come back. The good flora will come back. In the same way that often, you know, the period, the reproductive system will go completely out of whack. But if given time, that will come back too. It's just a matter of realigning the body, bringing it back into harmony with nature, and giving it the opportunity to empty the cells of the waste and have the pathways flowing again, because the body wants to come back to life. It wants to get switched back on. It just needs us to remove what's blocking it, what's preventing it, what's keeping it switched off.
Natalia?
Yep.
Yeah, that was great. So what about also the damage to the colon wall?
Okay, well that, I mean, a couple of things there. One is that some people actually, you know, because we're talking about, when we talk about the modern world and modern organs, we have to take for granted that they're compromised organs. And so if you take somebody who's had, who has a history of all this impaction, then they probably have a fairly misshapen colon. When you look at the colon in textbooks, you're not looking at the, you know, you're seeing a perfect colon, of a child, maybe who's never had rice, cereal, and formula. But give it a few decades, and the colon starts to get pretty, you know, warped out of shape. So if you combine an impacted colon that's totally misshapen with, say, a pressurized colonic, and the administrator of the colonic is out of touch, which, you know, you can't assume that they all know what they're doing, you know, just because they're doing colonics. If they're doing pressurized colonics, I'd pretty much assume they don't know what they're doing. And so you create this perfect storm, this, for, you know, this kind of incident. That's the only way I could see it happening, not through somebody who's gently awakening and releasing, as we do, who's having a gravity-fed treatment, and who's going to a therapist or is self-treating, knowing, you know, how the flow should work, you know, if things are being backed into the intestine, you know, and they're not understanding that and not recognizing that. It's one of those things that I've never heard of anybody who's done this work have that happen to them in the entire history of my practice. So, you know, in 12 years and working with agony, I couldn't count the number of people I've worked with, the number of people who've read the books, who've, you know, we've worked with in classes. It's probably, gosh, I mean, it's got to be well over a couple hundred thousand. Never heard one report that's been negative. But, you know, that there are, evidently, according to doctors and people who are concerned, they do their research and they see that there are cases out there. And all I can do is assume, that that they're just, that all the factors involved are out of balance or unideal, or, you know, I think you get what I'm trying to say.
Okay, great. Thank you, Natalia. A couple more questions from the living room. One is, how do you know when you're yeasted, and then how do you know when you're no longer yeasted?
Right, great one. I remember that one too. Okay, so basically, the best way to know if you're yeasted is to ask yourself, am I a woman? Am I living in the modern world? And then if you answer yes to those two questions, then I would consider the symptoms, and we'll talk about those in a second. And the third thing that if you say yes to pretty much guarantees it is, have I taken birth control for more than 2 or 3 years? And, you know, sort of with and, or maybe it's an additional question, have I been on several cycles of antibiotics in my life? So those are the basic questions. Now, if you're a man, you can still be yeasted. I'm seeing more and more yeast issues in men, and the way to tell with men is the symptom is usually one of physical structure. men will start to take on a more feminine shape, meaning that, and I'm sure you know if this applies to you and you've seen this out in the world, a man who's kind of hippie, who's, it's easy to tell if they've got the man boobs, whose skin tissue is a little bit soft, has a hard time putting on muscle, who just is kind of become feminine in a physical way, but doesn't have to be, you know, to a huge extent, can just be looking a little bit like that. And that's usually a way to tell for guys, and it's very, very easily remedied if this work is done, if the yeast conscious approach is used. And then the symptoms to look for, they can be very varied. I mean, there's a huge number of symptoms, but basically foggy headedness and moodiness from a mental and emotional perspective, it's a very dangerous cycle, because if you're having these issues and you're taking antidepressants, then, most people who have these issues wind up taking something for them, but then these exacerbate the yeast problem even more. Pharmaceutical drugs are one of the biggest offenders when it comes to yeast. So, it becomes a major kind of double-edged sword if you're trying to fight yeast and you're taking these. But anything to do with that, being overly emotional or being mentally unclear, physically having a hard time losing weight, being very puffy, kind of that lower body puffiness. It can also be midsection puffiness. Carrying extra weight in general is usually a problem. If you're feeling very feeling like you constantly need starches and sugars, if you feel like you could potentially have an addiction to sugar or white flour, that's your yeast monster wanting to get fed. So it's not necessarily your authentic desire to have those things. It's the yeast monster trying to stay alive, who's sending the message saying, consume this because I need this to live. So those are the major ones. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that's obvious. I mean, well, the obvious things like the yeast infections, but not everybody has yeast infections who's very yeasted. On babies, we see thrush. Often skin symptoms will be yeast. So acne, psoriasis, eczema, that's when it's really dire. If you have those things, you should just approach the cleansing or approach your dietetics assuming that you're yeasted. And, you certainly don't need to go and have your bowels checked for yeast. You can if you want to, but I just think that this work needs to be done by so many people that just because of how we live, the estrogenic environment, the acidity, I would just take it as a given if you have any of those symptoms. And, if you wanted to be absolutely positive, go ahead and do that. But, only in a few cases do I think that's necessary.
Okay, great. And so I guess then on the flip side, you're not yeasted if you don't have any of those things.
Yeah, and I would just want to add one thing, which is I think I remember somebody also asked, when can you go back to fruits, or how do you live once you've cleaned up the yeast? Well, it's important that your antenna is always up for it, that you're always on the lookout for the yeast monster creeping back in. And that's because, again, it's the estrogens and the acidity in the environment. So, for example, someone like me living in the heart of New York City, I might know that I don't have a yeast issue, but if I start, and I love fruits, and I do a lot of fruits now, and I'm so grateful that I can, because there was a time when I really worked the yeast starvation diet, and I was so careful. I remember, the hot summer when all I wanted in the world was watermelon, and so I'd have to come up with these, using lemon and cucumbers and tomatoes to try to mimic the experience of fruit and with a little stevia, and that's what worked for me. It got me over it. So I just remember, how I started to value fruit, but I'm very careful now because of where I live. If I, I wouldn't do fruit for more than 2 or 3 days in a row living in this environment. I'm careful to do fruits and then to leave them alone and make sure that I'm yeast conscious for a while, because it can very quickly, you know, get a grip again into your body, especially because our fruits are so denatured. So even if I'm getting organic fruits, you know, in today's world, that's kind of ambiguous. You know, it's hard to know exactly what that means. That I still find that all the organic produce, and you can watch this yourselves, both organic and non-organic produce, but, you know, to a greater extent in the non-organic produce, you'll see this happen, that every year the fruits and vegetables will look worse. I'm finding that my organic apples, which are usually amazing this time of year, are a mixed bag now. Sometimes I get them and they're crispy and crunchy and you can really, they taste wholesome and beautiful, and then you'll get a whole bunch that just are very flowery, and you can tell that they just don't have the same integrity that they should have. The grapefruits, I see that happening, you know, very quickly. So just because they're organic doesn't mean they're what we would have had 3,000 years ago. And so it's one of these things where we're just at this very unique, complicated juncture in human history where we can't take anything for granted. Nothing's a hard and fast rule. It's not, okay, I'm not yeast, so I can have fruit. Well, you know, where do you live? Where's your fruit coming from? Now, I choose not to let my mind kind of go into all that stuff, because to me it's a waste of time to think about dietetics. If the point is, figure out how the body works, learn how to take care of it, have a system of eating that you know works for you, and then move on with your life. Like, be creative. Do the things you love. If it means that, you know, that this work is work that you love and you want to counsel people in that and you want to write about, great. But becoming obsessed with the minutia of food is not where we want to go with this. But we do need to understand that we can't take things for granted. We have to constantly be watching how the dynamic is shifting. So it's shifting every day right in front of us, moment to moment. And if we don't pay attention to the changes and we just hold fast to the rules because, you know, that's what the book said, that, you know, that's all going to evolve. I'm evolving. So, you know, in 5 years, I'm going to be talking about what's going on the planet right now. In 5 years, not what's going on the planet right now. And when you seek out health professionals, you want to see two things. You want to know that they are thinking in the present, not in the past. And you want to see that they are a living example of what they do. You want to see that the whites of their eyes are clear. You want to see that, the physical integrity that they have. Doesn't mean that, you know, that they have to be your ideal beauty. They may not look like a supermodel, but do they look healthy? Are they embodying something that that's working? You know, and these, you know, because a lot of you will be seeking out guidance in this area, maybe exploring other alternative areas of health, you can always go back to that, and it can be very helpful. But I think I've gotten off topic there.
Okay, great, Natalia, thank you. Kind of along those lines is that there's some recipes on the dashboard that are including nutritional yeast, or I'm sorry, in the living room. Mm-hmm. If one is not yeasted, is it okay to include nutritional yeast in recipes on the cleanse?
Yeast, nutritional yeast is not yeast feeding. I know it seems kind of weird, but it's not a part of the yeast feeding issues. I personally don't use it because the concept of it kind of skeeves me, but I know that a lot of people do and they love it. So, and it's, you know, it's supposed to be absolutely fine for yeast. So you can go ahead and use it if you want to. I just don't, but, you know, that's just a personal thing. I think, you know, okay. The people that I know who use it with great success.
Great. Okay. Now, can you talk about Rolfing a little bit? That's another one from the living room. And actually, if you have any more questions, too, that you want to ask live, go ahead and press 1 on your keypad. But Rolfing came up, too. There's questions about what it is and what that's all about.
Yeah. Rolfing is one of the best things you can do for yourself. I discovered Rolfing about maybe 10 years ago. I had a full Rolfing session with the most wonderful Rolfer, and I'm going to try to pull up her number as I respond to this. And yes, I have it here. Okay. If you're in New York City, or if you want to get a recommendation for somebody near you, she may be able to help you too. Her name is Beth Francesi, and I can, I'll send this to you, Amanda, so you can put it up on the living room. But her number is 212-213 212-213-0820. 212-213-0820. I mention this because it's very hard to find a really great Rolfer. So she's probably the best in her field, and you can reach out to her for maybe a recommendation if she knows someone near you. Okay, so Rolfing is extremely powerful. It basically it's a way to get into the connective tissue to release both emotional baggage that's been stored there and to correct skeletal muscular, disharmony. Basically, just like it will fix your skeletal muscular system by working on the connective tissue. It can be kind of painful, but in a way, it's kind of awesomely painful. There's a distinct euphoria that comes, you know. And I'm not a sadomasochist. I don't like to hurt, but this is a particular good hurt. It's deep. It hurts a little bit, but then there's this euphoria that comes on the other side of it, and it will really realign you. People do sob on in their Rolfing sessions because it also releases a lot of stored emotions. You know, the body doesn't lie. It doesn't. One of the things that happens in nature we don't do that animals do is when say an impala is frightened by coming face to face with a lion, and it gets away, the jaws of the lion, you know, by the skin of its teeth, and that impala then is going to go, and it's going to find a quiet, safe place, and it's going to shake. It's going to shake off all that negativity, all that negative energy that it had to use, all that adrenaline it had to use to give it that fight and flight instinct. So we encounter things that scare us, that that make us nervous, that stress us out on a moment-to-moment basis in some cases. And not only do we not go off and shake it off, but we don't do anything usually, not even cry. Babies get scared and they cry, or children get scared and they cry, so they release this. But the more we suppress symptoms, the more we suppress how we really feel, the more we hold it in the body. So if we're experiencing all this on a day-to-day basis and we're not releasing it, it's being stored in the body. And as I said, the body doesn't lie. So this is another reason why people who can do everything right dietetically for years and, you know, maybe do colonics and do all these other things that, that are healing tools, that they don't necessarily heal. Well, have they not addressed what could be emotionally stored in their bodies? What's in their subconscious? What's in their unconscious mind? And, and Rolfing can help to get at so much of this accumulated negative emotion that may be accumulated in the system. So it's doing two things. It's helping to release that, and it's helping to realign the body. The thing with Rolfing that you should know going in is that you really want to have a full 10 sessions, and that's what's necessary, because each time the Rolfer will work on a different part of your body. They'll, in best case, she'll take a picture of you, in your skivvies, and she'll show you, what she's going to work on, because she'll show you, how you'll just stand there, and she'll see what needs correcting. And then she'll do an after as well, and you'll see how much more aligned you are, and it's remarkable. But it's body part by body part, and it's, it can be, over a little bit over $100 for each treatment, so it's an investment. So I would take it, I would undertake the investment only if you could do all 10 sessions and you did them, say, once a week or so, because you want to benefit from doing them all linked up together.
A couple more real quick ones. Someone asked about fungal defense while nursing. Is it okay to take that?
Yeah, fungal defense is great. Anything that is going to help eradicate the yeast is wonderful, and now is a very appropriate time to do it. You can do...
Even Candex and Candygon, because it specifically says not to do it while nursing, but...
Oh, sorry, did you say while nursing? I think I was getting a click. While nursing, I wouldn't... while nursing, I would probably stick with something like just oregano oil. Okay. And maybe just using that in the salads. I would use raw garlic in the salads as long as it doesn't put baby off. While nursing, I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question. No, I probably wouldn't even do the fungal defense, because the first time you do fungal defense, it's really strong. In fact, I remember the T-shirt I was wearing the first day when I took the fungal defense. It's not a bad smell, but it's very herby. And I remember just taking my T-shirt off and it smelling like the fungal defense. It smelled of oregano and all these intense herbs. So I think that would come through the breast milk in abundance, and you may or may not, the baby may or may not like that. So I would probably not do that, but you know, do the other things you can do, abstaining from these feeding substances. Although, you know, while nursing, it's kind of like, you know, while pregnant, in order to make sure you don't want to do any of these things while you're developing your milk supply. Meaning such a yeast conscious approach. I mean, yes, avoid white sugars, avoid white flour, all of that stuff. But fruit sugar may be needed, because fruits are one of the best building blocks of good mother's milk. So until your milk supply is fully established, don't look to fully eradicate the fruits, or if you feel like you need some grains like the sprouted grain breads or some spelt pasta or something like that now and then. It's not something that every woman needs. And certainly grain does not make milk, but it can be hard when you're that hungry and you're nursing to abstain from all of these things just at that point. But after your milk supply is well established, meaning you're well beyond the third month, you can pull the fruit as long as your milk supply stays strong, and just make sure to get lots and lots of greens. And if you're doing that, you're going to start starving off the yeast anyway, because remember, most importantly, that if you simply just stop feeding the quantities of yeast you were feeding before, then the yeast is going to start to die off. So if you're feeding 100 yeast one day and then the next day you're feeding 50 yeast, well, 50 yeast are going to starve. So even if you're not taking the yeast out completely, you're starving enough to start to get a handle on it, so that yeast monster is less intimidating. It's not running your life so much. So, you know, don't stress it if you're not 100% yeast-free in terms of your dietetic approach, or, you know, yeast-feeding-free. If you've taken a big leap for what you used to do, then that's enough. So, you know, in this case, as Anna said, I love what she said, your best is good enough. In this case, your best is good enough.
All right. Thank you so much. That's all the time that we have today, and we got through a lot of people's questions, so that was great. Natalia, thank you. That was just a wealth of information today.
This audio and the Guided Rose Cleanse is a source of information only. The information contained in this audio and in all Guided Rose Cleanse materials should by no means be considered a substitute for the advice of a qualified medical professional, who should always be consulted before beginning any new diet or other health program. Detox the World disclaims any liability for any adverse effects arising from the use or application of the information contained herein.